building a nationwide network of 500,000 charging stations, creating good-paying jobs by leading the world in the manufacturing and export of clean electric cars and trucks. We're going to provide tax incentives and point-of-sale rebates to help all American families afford clean vehicles of the future.
Well, after 4 years of waiting, it is finally Infrastructure Week. President Biden unveiled his $2.25 trillion infrastructure plan yesterday in Pittsburgh. It would still have to be approved by Congress, and Biden wants to pay for it mostly by raising taxes on corporations. The plan includes money to improve roads and bridges, public transportation, passenger rail, and $174 billion for electric vehicles, for things like building charging stations and making more school buses and mail trucks electric. We're going to talk about this now and how California specifically would benefit from Biden's plan with Alan Ohnsman. He covers transportation and technology for Forbes. He's based here in L.A. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, how much would California benefit from Biden's plan?
I don't think you can underestimate the impact for the state. California is already by far the biggest market for electric vehicles in the nation. I think in 2020, it's over 50% of all new EVs are sold in California. And the state is already on this very aggressive timetable to convert all new passenger vehicles to either battery powered or hydrogen powered by 2035. And so, you know, here that's the backdrop. And here comes the Biden infrastructure plan with lots of money, tax incentives, support for manufacturing. It's enormous. So the likelihood that California can maybe achieve that goal of converting to all electric vehicle sales by 2035 looks more doable if this plan is to pass.
Well, talk about these incentives. Would they be for customers buying electric cars and also for the companies that make them?
Exactly. All of the above. We already have incentives that exist. Late stage Bush era, there were federal tax incentives that were approved. And those went into effect a few years later. Companies like Tesla and GM have already run through all their tax incentives. They long ago ran through a couple hundred thousand vehicles of sales. And what's being talked about is expanding the tax incentives and perhaps taking both state-level rebates and federal tax incentives and making them available at point of sale, which has never been the case. So that's a huge thing. Currently, you buy your EV, you apply for the state rebate, or you tick a box on your tax return to get the federal tax credit. So it comes later. It's a deferred benefit. This would be point of sale. So in California, you could knock like 10 grand off the cost of a new vehicle. So suddenly a $40,000 or $50,000 vehicle becomes way more affordable to more people.
Oh, wow. So if it was 40,000, then take 10,000 off. It's 30,000. Yeah. And a lot more people would say, okay, I can do that.
Exactly.
Well, the other sticking point, though, for a lot of people when it comes to buying electric cars is range anxiety and not finding a charging station nearby. How would this plan address that?
That it really does go a fairly long way to do that. 500,000 additional charging stations would be a lot. Here in California, we have, depending on how you count, between 25 and 50,000 charging stations, but not all of those are public. 500,000 new stations, you know, a big chunk of those obviously would be in California, but it would open up, you know, other markets as well. The key thing is we have urban area charging clustered in Los Angeles, the Bay Area, and different big cities in California, less so statewide. So if you want to drive up to the Bay Area on the 5, your options are not nearly as good, and you're going to be a little more nervous about being able to refuel your vehicle. This would go a long way to make that possible. I don't know that a lot of people are regularly needing to drive between the Bay and L.A., but certainly having, you know, let's say California gets at least 10 or 12% of those new stations, an additional 50 to 60,000 charging stations in California would be a big deal. So to relieve that anxiety people might have about range.
Right. And would they be universal? Like these charging stations could be used by every single car that's electric?
Yeah, I think the industry is already heading that way. I mean, everyone's got a different standard. Tesla has its own plug and the CHAdeMO system, and there have been different plugs, but there is a commonization happening within the industry. So fast charge level 3 is heading towards a common standardized plug. So by the time a lot of these start opening up, they would be generally accessible. But see, that's on top of a lot of activity that's already taking place, because certainly in this state, we have a lot of companies that are already setting up and expanding their charging network. So it just makes life that much easier if you do want to own an EV.
So I imagine all these companies are pretty excited today.
Oh, yeah. It's a big deal. And I think especially if you look at Tesla and General Motors, I mean, Tesla is sort of the benchmark right now. They've used up all of their tax credits. So this lets them reload, and suddenly they get more competitive on price. And General Motors is in the same boat. They also ran through all their credits, and they are ramping up their efforts to expand their EV offerings. They just have a new version of the Bolt that's come out. So for them in particular, this is a big deal. But we've got, you know, startup battery companies in LA and the Bay Area and a raft of new EV startups like Fisker and Lucid and companies like Arrival that are coming over. So everyone is pretty jazzed about this because it just supports what was already happening. You know, it just accelerates the momentum that is occurring in the space.
Right. And this is all if it passes Congress, which is a big if yeah. Right?
Yeah. Although if you read through the infrastructure plan and the way it's tied to jobs, it's a pretty clever, you know, proposal, because it touches every part of the U.S. in some way, whether it's rural broadband or rail connections and transit and, you know, highway improvements and everything. So there is something for everyone to love and probably something for everyone to hate in it as well.
Well, speaking of something that everyone loves to hate, what about high-speed rail here in California? Is there money in this package for that specifically?
To be decided. So the as proposed, it doesn't specify where the rail money would go, but there's definitely money for high-speed rail, $80 billion in total. $80 billion would probably pay for, you know, what's outstanding with the California project. And the California program is not identified explicitly in this, so it will have to compete with other projects. One of the things that fascinated me was Amtrak put out a really interesting graphic after this came out showing upgraded service across the country, including upgrades to existing lines like, say, the Pacific Surfliner between LA and San Diego. So I think there's some discussion about what could be done to speed that up. I know there's also talk Metrolink wants to try to maybe electrify from Burbank to Anaheim and speed the Metrolink service here in LA County. So that would be interesting. So there's going to be a lot of competition for that money. For sure, we know the Northeast Corridor with Amtrak is probably going to get turned into a true high-speed rail corridor. For California's project, no explicit set aside for that one.
All right. Stay tuned, as they say. Alan, thank you.
Great. Thanks for talking, Madeline.
Oh, my pleasure. Alan Ownsman, he covers the intersection of transportation and technology for Forbes here in Los Angeles. Well, another slice of Biden's $2 trillion plus infrastructure plan is addressing racial inequalities and environmental justice. And one major element of this, $20 billion to reconnect some historically black neighborhoods divided and isolated by highway construction. Here to tell us more is Ian Duncan. He's transportation reporter at The Washington Post. Hi.
Hello.
Well, let's begin with New Orleans. The highway was constructed in the 60s there, and there's a ramp in a neighborhood called Treme. And what happened when that project was completed? What did it do to that neighborhood?
So this is a highway that was built along what had been a big kind of wide open oak-lined street, home to a lot of businesses, black-owned businesses in many cases. In the 60s, as you said, the highway was just kind of slapped on top of the existing avenue, and it just completely changed the character of that area. It means that the people that live there now are kind of faced with this huge concrete structure between them and the rest of the city, and all the pollution that then comes from having a highway, you know, right outside your window.
Right. And one woman in particular has been very vocal about this, a woman who lives there named Amy Stelly. And she's been advocating for that highway ramp there to be removed. And the president heard her call. So what is happening with that?
So the president's plan has this $20 billion fund that would be used to kind of reconnect these neighborhoods that wouldn't necessarily all be for taking down highways, although there is a lot of interest in doing that in cities across the country. And it's an idea that's sort of been really gaining traction as these mid-20th century highways sort of get to the end of the life that they were designed for. Ideas about, you know, just taking them down wholesale, burying them underground in some cases, or you can do sort of smaller things too, like you can find ways to build footbridges over the top of them, or ways for people sort of on foot and bike to get across them.
Yeah, because they have, it's not just in New Orleans, but across the country, have cut off neighborhoods. I'm thinking of the South Bronx, for example, have cut off neighborhoods from the rest of the city. And that's been very detrimental for the residents there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pretty much I think every sizable city in the country has a road like this. And when they were built, there was just so little consideration given to residents living in what sort of planners thought were slums at the time.
You've reported that in Seattle, the city successfully removed a highway that cut through parts of the city and put it underground.
That's right. Yeah, it's called the Alaskan Way Viaduct. And so it ran sort of ran right along the waterfront in Seattle. So this sort of pretty otherwise beautiful area. But to get from one part of downtown down to the water, you had to kind of go under this highway viaduct. And yeah, what they did there was they put it sort of deep in these tunnels. And they're now sort of in the process of figuring out what comes next. But the transportation director there sort of said the idea is you would create like a ribbon kind of park that would run along the space that's created as a result of taking the road away.
I imagine that was very expensive. And so how much money is set aside for projects like this in Biden's plan?
Right. So the fund is $20 billion. And so the sort of the costs, like there's a plan in Syracuse in New York to do this that would sort of be about $2 billion in construction costs. So it gives you a sense of the scale. So some other plans are sort of smaller, several hundred million. But then on top of that, the people who are involved in this work say you need other money to ensure that people don't get displaced, because hopefully you make these neighborhoods much more desirable. And if you kind of leave that to the private sort of property market, then there's a worry that this will just sort of lead to gentrification and displacement. And so it's not just the money for the construction that you need. And the mayor of Syracuse was saying yesterday to me that he would hope that some of that money that Biden is calling for could be used for those other purposes as well.
Well, I wonder how politically viable this is, because people, you know, on both sides of the aisle tend to get pretty upset when they think that their commute might get longer because of construction or the removal of part of the highway that they take every day to go in and out of work. So is this something that would get a lot of skepticism when it's debated in Congress?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, we saw when Pete Buttigieg was coming up for confirmation as transportation secretary that you heard Republicans sort of say, like, we don't want to turn the Department of Transportation into a sort of social justice agency. But of course, there is a long history of doing civil rights work at the department. But it's not something that's sort of universally popular, and it potentially pits kind of suburban residents who prize being able to get into town really quickly and out of town again really quickly against people who kind of actually live in these communities. And so, you know, it's not completely straightforward by any stretch of the imagination.
And meanwhile, there is also, I believe, a doubling of money, public money for transportation, for public transportation.
Yeah, right? That's right. So that's one of the other really big sort of dramatic things that the president is calling for. You know, some of these things fit together, right? they want to electrify these transit buses, so they're not using diesel, which is good for sort of the environment writ large in terms of greenhouse gases, but it's good for people who locally kind of live near where bus lines are. It's good for people who use transit potentially. If you can have faster service, you can get where you want to go. And so the ideal version of this is that if you encourage more people to get on buses, presumably some of them are then not using cars, and that makes the roads a little bit freer for cars too. Like, that's how you sort of pitch this as a virtuous thing. But again, there will be Republicans certainly who will look at this and say, well, you know, advertisers don't use transit, and this is just taking money from gas taxes paid by drivers to benefit another group of people who maybe don't need that help.
Ian, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's Ian Duncan. He's transportation reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up, is Major League Baseball doing enough to atone for past segregation? We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is baseball's opening day, and I want to take you back almost 50 years to April 8th, 1974, the night Atlanta's Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's hallowed home run record. The Braves were playing the Dodgers that night, so here's legendary announcer Vin Scully with the call.
Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone. For baseball, what a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol. And it is a great moment for all of us, and particularly for Henry Aaron.
Hank Aaron was one of the last full-time major leaguers who spent the early part of his career playing in the Negro Leagues. All-black baseball thrived at the height of Jim Crow, before Jackie Robinson of the then Brooklyn Dodgers broke baseball's color barrier. Just a month before Hank Aaron died, Major League Baseball announced it would include decades worth of Negro League figures in its official record books, a way to honor past players never given their proper due and to try to atone for the injustice of segregated baseball. Is it enough? Well, maybe not, says my next guest. Rowan Ricardo Phillips is a poet, historian, and author well known for his sports writing, and he wrote about this in the New York Times Magazine this past week. The headline, Justice for the Negro Leagues Will Mean More Than Just Stats. And Rowan Ricardo Phillips joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, Hank Aaron, he died a few months ago, and as we mentioned, he was one of the last full-time Negro League players to be in the major leagues. You write that he is the player where statistics and society meet. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's go back, for instance, to when Babe Ruth broke the all-time home run record. It's not something that we come back to. And I just think that when you think about the cataclysmic uproar that was Hank Aaron's slow but steady march to 715 home runs, it was a moment when the nation really took to heart not just the achievement that Aaron was undertaking, but the cost. You know, Henry Aaron set a record he never would have wanted to set leading up to breaking Babe Ruth's home run record, and that was the most amount of fan mail received in a year by a private individual. But a lot of that fan mail was in the form of death threats to him and to his family. So the problem wasn't for Aaron statistical. It was a moment when you really got a sense of what to a large swath of society certain numbers mean. And they're not about sports per se, but they're about, as is often the case with sports, what it means to be a human being, what it means to be alive, and who we feel that we can be okay honoring. And once you break a hallowed record like Henry Aaron was about to do and then subsequently did, then there's no argument left. So you could see the way in which everyone was looking at this as not just one home run after another. There's 703, there's 704, there's 705, but rather what we do with those numbers and why. It's not the number that's important. It's rather the how and the when and the why.
Yeah, right. So the number is just kind of an arbitrary statistic in a sense, but it does say a lot, as we heard from Vin Scully in his excited call. It says what America hoped it was, moving past segregation into integration into a better, more just place. But as you say, given the fact that Hank Aaron then had to receive all of these letters, all this hate mail, seriously a double-edged sword. And I guess I'm wondering how that weighed on him and how that weighed on other Black players at the time.
Well, you know, the irony of it all is that he said, actually, at the moment after he hit the home run and he was interviewed, you know, he said, thank God it's over. And he was well known, even to the end of his life, to say publicly that he didn't enjoy the moment. But Henry Aaron's ascent to, you know, the home run throne, if you will, wasn't just about him, and he really understood that. He wrote an article that was syndicated in papers as he was getting up to 715 home runs, remembering that he played for the Negro Leagues, that he started with the Indianapolis Clowns, and that there were a lot of players who didn't have the opportunity and good fortune, and it must be said talent, that he had to express himself on an integrated team in the major leagues.
So he, Hank Aaron, he was in the Negro Leagues for a very short time, right? He was with the Indianapolis Clowns. And now there is this move by Major League Baseball, they announced in December, that, and I just want to read their statement, MLB is correcting a longtime oversight in the game's history by officially elevating the Negro Leagues to Major League status. First of all, before we get into that statement and the wording of it, what exactly will they be doing? What does it mean that they are now elevating, as they say, the Negro Leagues to Major League status?
Well, that, Madeline, is the $50 million question. The idea thus far is to consider the Negro League records from 1920 to about 1948. As being the period that they would consider for absorption, I guess, into the Major League record books. That would be because 1920 was when the Negro Leagues, as we know them, was officially founded by Rube Foster and his colleagues. It was an amalgamation of seven leagues, which is why it's called the Negro Leagues as opposed to the Negro League singular. And the last kind of year in which there was enough data, I guess they feel, in the form of box scores and game reports and the such like that, takes us to about 1948. And from what I understand, it's still very much a work in progress. And that's the story. So the idea would be, for instance, Josh Gibson's 441 batting average would be all of a sudden the last major leaguer to have hit over 400. Right now it's been Ted Williams, but now it would be Josh Gibson. This, I think, is all phenomenal.
Yeah, so what's the harm in that? Like, it sounds great on the face of it to include players from the Negro Leagues in the Major League statistics. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with it? I think that there's, first of all, you know, as I wrote in the story, the notion of elevating these players to Major League status is incredibly problematic. The implication is that the Negro Leagues were beneath Major League Baseball. And that's certainly not the case. So there's no need to elevate players' records to any level. Two, there's a danger in retroactively adjusting the historical record. The players in the Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1948 are just like the Black baseball players from 1867 to 1947. Who were denied an opportunity to play professional baseball in the major leagues. It's important, I think, to understand that continuum of Black baseball from the 19th century, and really the middle part of the 19th century, well into the 20th century, past Jackie Robinson, into the 1950s, as being a single entity and not separating, you know, 29 years of that history, because while there's enough data by which to elevate these players and consider them major leaguers, I think that what's far more important for the historical record is having everything together.
Well, I guess, the issue is, right, they're making this statement, and it was at the end of a tumultuous year where we had a lot of protests, Black Lives Matter-led protests, and it seems like baseball wanted to make a statement.
And the 100-year anniversary of the founding of the Negro Leagues. Absolutely.
Right. And it seems like Major League Baseball wanted to do something to acknowledge its past. But what you're saying is it's not doing enough. It's not really telling the whole story. It's telling just a fraction of the story. And that is in itself a whitewashing. And, you know, as you say, statistics without a story, they're pretty hollow.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, I think they're in a very complicated position, because I think that they certainly understand the history. Negro League history is rich and vast, and there have been incredible historians kind of kept these stories alive. But I do think that, yeah, there's one thing to say, well, wouldn't it be nice if, when we think about righting a wrong, wouldn't it be nice if is just the absolutely wrong way to approach it. But I would dearly hope that there's an embrace towards what this is supposed to do, which is you can't right the wrongs. However, what you can do for going forward that would be by far the most important is laying out the history.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about your piece. It's fascinating. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Madeline.
That's Rowan Ricardo Phillips, poet, historian, and author. Coming up, why we don't talk about miscarriage.
I wasn't offered things like a lock of hair or footprints or handprints or a funeral, any of that.
Damaging myths and stereotypes around miscarriage. We're going to talk to the author of a new book about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Psychologist Jessica Zucker counsels people struggling with pregnancy, people who have lost children, people overwhelmed with anxiety about the process. But when she miscarried at home by herself, she grappled with how to take the advice she so readily doled out to her clients. Slow down. Don't blame yourself. Don't compare. Roughly one in every four pregnancies ends in miscarriage, but women often don't talk about it, maybe because they feel ashamed or like the loss was somehow their fault. After hers, Zucker began sharing her experience on social media using the hashtag #IHadAMiscarriage. She created an online community with mothers around the world dealing with grief and shame surrounding the losses of their pregnancies. And now she has turned these stories, including her own, into a new book. It's called I Had a Miscarriage, A Memoir, A Movement. And just a warning that some of what we get into is going to be a detailed description of Jessica's miscarriage. Jessica Zucker, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. And that figure, one out of every four pregnancies ends in miscarriage, it's probably higher than most people believe or most people assume. What are some of the main reasons women miscarry?
Yes, it's so true that most people think that miscarriage happens a lot less frequently than it does. And the research has found that a majority of miscarriages are due to chromosomal or genetic abnormalities. But people tend to blame themselves. So I think with the lack of information, unfortunately, women are often turning it on themselves. So they question, did I not drink enough water? Did I exercise too much? Should I not have had sex? Should I not have had that sip of wine? And so rather than really sort of turning to the basic science around pregnancy and pregnancy loss, people are taking on the responsibility on themselves.
Mm-hmm. And where do these ideas come from? This idea that, as you say, I shouldn't have had that wine or I shouldn't have gone to that exercise class. Where does all that come from?
I think it comes from, you know, the fact that girls and women are groomed, I think, from the get-go to blame themselves for a variety of things when it comes to our reproductive health and reproductive outcomes. And so in the absence of information, we can fill it in with projections or fears or anxiety. And so people make meaning out of things that don't necessarily add up.
Well, let's talk about what happened to you. You were pregnant with your second child. You had a young son already. And you were just into your second trimester, about 16 weeks along, when you miscarried. What happened?
So 2 days prior, I started spotting and I went directly to my doctor's office and the heartbeat was perfect. The placenta looked great. And so she sent me on my way. We were curious. We had no idea what was going on. It was very unsettling, but I tried to sort of go about my life as if everything was moving in an okay direction. The following day I went to work. But then that night on my drive home, I started experiencing what I now understand to be Braxton Hicks.
Which are contractions.
Yes. Right. Yes. Early contractions.
Yeah, early contractions.
Which, you know, one would not typically feel at 16 weeks along. So I knew that this was very problematic and that this was probably not going to have a good outcome. And then the following morning, my husband took my son to preschool. And I decided I would stay home and relax, but the blood, you know, changed in intensity and hue. And I just knew that this pregnancy was bound to end. And a few hours later, I went to the bathroom. I was feeling pretty overwhelmed, which what I didn't realize at the time, and I do now, is I was actually in active labor. So the feeling of overwhelm was really because I was about to expel, my body was going to expel the baby. And I sat down to go to the bathroom and the baby actually fell out. Mm. So I texted my doctor and she called me immediately and walked me through what to do over the phone. So I had to cut the umbilical cord myself. And then I promptly began to hemorrhage. All the while my husband, you know, sped home. We took the baby in a bag to my doctor's office so that she could test the fetus. And then I had to undergo an unmedicated DNC. So long story short, even though I'm a psychologist, I specialize in women's reproductive and maternal mental health and have done so for about 15 years at this point, I had never undergone something this traumatic. I had never experienced a miscarriage firsthand until I did.
And you were all alone. And as you say, that is common with women who miscarry. How do you remember how you were feeling in that moment? Was it just still a blur in your mind?
It was kind of a simultaneous blur and a speeding up of time. You know, I felt like it was kind of, I was living in a documentary. I mean, I had never really heard of something like this in all my years of sitting across from people telling me their loss experiences. You typically go to the doctor and find out there's no heartbeat. So giving birth basically alone in the context of my home was surreal beyond measure. And initially, I felt a physical feeling of relief, actually, because I was in so much pain leading up to the birth. And then I quickly realized that unless I kept going, that unless I mustered the stamina, the energy to keep going, I could have bled out right there and then.
And so after that experience, I guess you were discharged or you left your doctor's office. You weren't even in the hospital, right?
That's right.
You were discharged, sent home, and with any instructions from your doctor? What were you supposed to do after that?
No, I mean, in terms of, you know, a to-do list, there really wasn't one. And there really wasn't a conversation around, you know, how might things go for you from here, psychologically speaking, physically speaking. And even though I had sat across from patients for years and years, hearing about the feelings of isolation and alienation and grief, I just had never, you know, corporeally experienced this myself. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of flung me into new territory professionally and personally.
But you returned to work fairly quickly.
I don't know what I was thinking. Yes, I did. It's not like it sounded appealing to lay in bed and think through all the gory details of what had happened. I was also already a mother, so I didn't want to model that for my child. I didn't want him to be worried about me. I also felt, because I am a psychologist, very loyal to my patients, and I did not want them to begin to worry about me.
What was it like then when you went back? How did you talk about this with your patients? Because, I mean, therapists don't normally talk about their personal lives with their patients, but
that's right.
In your circumstance, you were actually living the experience that a lot of them feared the most.
That's right. And I was forced to talk about it because my pregnancy was so obvious. Patients don't typically know anything about their therapist. A therapist could be struggling, you know, with depression, anxiety, an eating disorder, getting divorced even, and a patient wouldn't have any idea. But when the therapist is visibly pregnant, there is no way you can get around talking about the loss of it, if that's what happens. And as you said, because I specialize in this, so many of my patients had been through this or feared this. And I didn't know upon my return how patients would react. And some had very strong feelings about it. Some were incredibly worried about me. A couple of people decided that they would take time off from our sessions because it was too triggering. And others actually felt very almost closer to me, or sort of reassured, I guess, that their therapist was in fact human. And that now that I had been through it firsthand, I could actually understand them.
And did you feel that way?
Well, I do now. I mean, my loss was in 2012. And I think that initially when I came back, it was hard to hold their stories, my story, their stories, my story. It was a lot. And I should mention, you know, my doctor suggested that we wait 3 cycles if we wanted to conceive again. So on the 4th cycle, I got pregnant again. So these very same patients saw me through yet another pregnancy, which brought up a whole other slew of things for them.
Hmm. So when you got pregnant, and you got pregnant, what, within a year or a few months, actually, after you lost
this baby? Yeah.
Yeah. You must have been terrified it would happen all over again.
Yeah, that's the perfect word for it. I was basically checking for blood every single time I went to the bathroom. I was convinced that this or something else would happen again. And it was hard because, you know, my OBGYN said, you know, perhaps after you do the chromosomal testing, you'll probably feel huge relief if everything's okay. And it was. And when you get to the 16-week mark and you pass it, you will probably experience even more relief. And I was hoping that she was right. But unfortunately for me, given my unique position of sitting with patients and hearing about stories like stillbirth and infant loss and SIDS and having to terminate for medical reasons after the 20-week mark and so on, I was now rendered unable to be, I guess, in denial about the potential of becoming another statistic.
you had a healthy baby girl with your second pregnancy. And,
yes.
Noah.
Yes.
And I think it's interesting that after she was born, you decided you really needed to memorialize the baby you lost. Why did you decide that?
Well, I have to say that learning about the pregnancy loss community, mostly through social media and through sitting with my patients and hearing ways that they had memorialized and ritualized their losses, I became intrigued. I think because my loss was not deemed a stillbirth, because stillbirth is 20 weeks and beyond, I wasn't offered things like a lock of hair or footprints or handprints or a funeral, any of that. But after listening to so many other people have these various ways of ritualizing, I became intrigued and interested in doing the same. And I think I couldn't do it while I was pregnant with Noah because I was too scared. And so, yeah, I decided eventually to name that baby. And I started writing about this topic nonstop and decided basically to dedicate part of my life to changing the cultural conversation surrounding pregnancy and infant loss.
Why is it such a difficult conversation for us to have publicly still?
As a society, we struggle talking about grief, period. But then you add to it the fact that this is what I call an out-of-order loss, right? This isn't a loss of a grandparent or something you might expect along the way. This is an idea. It's an imagined family member. And so we rely on platitudes. And most of the platitudes that get thrown around in the wake of pregnancy and infant loss are just horrifying. And really send women, you know, running for the hills and feeling a sense of isolation and alienation when they need connection the most. So people rely on things like, well, it wasn't meant to be. God has a plan. Everything happens for a reason. At least you know you can get pregnant, rather than simply leaning into, you know, the grief with the person that they love, or, you know, asking the person, how are you feeling? I'm here for you if you want to talk about your loss. I'm so sorry that this happened.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show and sharing your story. And thank you for your book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Zucker, her new book is called I Had a Miscarriage, A Memoir, A Movement. Coming up, well, today is not just opening day for baseball, it's opening day for the new Amoeba Records. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Vinyl collectors and music fans are rejoicing because their North Star, Amoeba Music, is back. The legendary record store opens its new Hollywood location today, just a half mile from the previous store. That one was on Sunset next to the ArcLight. This one is on Hollywood Boulevard. Amoeba Music closed its old store a year ago after 20 years there. The move had been in the works before COVID, but lockdowns made it even harder to sustain. Now that streaming has completely upended physical CD and DVD sales, how does a store that specializes in those items and physical albums adapt, especially with COVID restrictions that limit how many customers can browse at a time? Andrea Dominic is the digital producer for music and culture here at KCRW. She spoke with Amoeba Music co-owner Jim Henderson about how Amoeba is adapting in the COVID era. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Madeline. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Well, let's talk about why this is such an iconic place, why it's so beloved. This company, Amoeba Music, it started up in the Bay Area in the 90s. How is it different from other record stores? What was so special about it?
Right. I mean, the thing that Amoeba is so well known for is its expansive size. I mean, its tagline is the world's largest independent record store. It's a physical space where you can get lost in the experience of music discovery. It's really known for having these kind of famously knowledgeable staff members, And it has not just music, but it has merch, posters, movies. You can go and buy and sell your own music there. You can trade stuff in. You can make a little money. So it's not just the reduced experience of pressing buy on Amazon or stream on Spotify. You go to Amoeba to physically go to Amoeba. And that also includes things like live performances, especially with its Hollywood location. It's a great destination for tourists. And bands love to stop through there and do record signings and play shows as well.
Hmm. So it's a full-on music experience that you obviously can't get online. What does the new space look like?
The new space definitely looks similar to the old space, these really high vaulted ceilings. It's technically a little bit smaller than its old location at Coinga and Sunset. When you walk into the new space, you're still going to see the racks upon racks upon racks of vinyl, you know, lots of neon signage. There's a mural from Shepherd Fairey adorning the stage. I think stuff's getting a little bit more compact as far as there being more boxes under the racks to really look for, you know, those deep cuts that you might be hunting for.
Well, all of that sounds like it costs a lot of money. Was it difficult for them to pay for all of that?
Yeah, it was difficult. In fact, once they shuttered last year, they actually had to have a GoFundMe where they raised at least $400,000.
You know, we kept our staff insured through this process, and, you know, insurance is not cheap. In order to do that, at one point, we actually did start a GoFundMe campaign. But again, we just were met with such a humbling response from the community to help bridge the enormous gap that we had. And so little things like that were not only helpful financially, but they were just spiritually buoying.
Well, I guess I'm wondering how this past year has affected him financially. Obviously, for a good portion of the year, people weren't able to go inside stores. And so were they able to pivot to online sales?
So while they did see a modest boost in online sales, that wasn't really enough to take them to where they needed to go. So there actually was a point, you know, where Jim told me that they were worried that they weren't going to come back. At one point, they were paying rent both on the old location and the new location. That combined with the fact that you just don't have people coming in and spending money, which they depended on, meant that they were stretched very, very thin.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And so how are they shifting to try to make up for that lost money?
Again, it's come down to community support. I know that the GoFundMe and other donations from the community have really kind of helped them, you know, get to this point where they're reopening today. Now, of course, you know, reopening and survival are two different things. It's also very hard, pretty much impossible to imagine in LA without Amoeba music. I think people are keen to get back in there, see the new space, and, you know, continue buying all of the great vinyl, DVDs, posters, and pop culture esoterica that they've come to know and love Amoeba for. And in fact, selling more of those pop culture items and getting more into the physical retail aspect is actually kind of how they're pivoting their new business model. It's less about, you know, people wanting to come in and get one record here, one poster there. But Jim was telling me people actually really like to buy kind of across the board when they're interested in one particular artist or, you know, film.
You know, you might be looking for a specific artist record, but then you might be interested in a book about that artist or a t-shirt for that artist or some other kind of tchotchke. So creating a little bit more of a widespread with the pop culture stuff and still going really deep on music as our, you know, kind of cornerstone.
And then, as you said earlier, Amoeba really is attractive to customers because of the people who come there to perform. So there have been some big names there. Paul McCartney performed there, for instance. And so will that continue in the new space?
Yes, absolutely. Obviously not right away, because even regular concerts still aren't coming back, and they're doing a very, you know, limited under capacity reopening at Amoeba as well. I know that that's something fans are excited for, and even musicians I've talked to have told me about, you know, how they can't wait to come back and play Amoeba again.
Have you seen any good performances there?
Oh, yeah. Especially, you know, in high school when, you know, venues were not all ages necessarily, I would love going to Amoeba. And the shows are free. You know, they can do meet and greets with the artists. I remember going to see the band Spoon from Austin there when I was like 16 or 17 with my best friend, and they were our favorite band at the time. And then it's funny because I ended up actually interviewing the singer, Britt Daniel, last year, and I mentioned that show to him, and he was like, dude, I remember that show. That was a great show. I still have friends I made at that show. So to me, that whole kind of full circle really captures what makes Amoeba special. It's a rare place to find a music community, you know, outside of typical spaces like concert venues and, you know, create lasting memories.
Well, Andrea, thank you.
Thanks so much, Madeline.
Andrea Dominik, digital producer for music and culture here at KCRW, talking about Amoeba Music reopening today. And that does it for us today on Press Play. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Picture yourself in a living room. Your pipe and slippers set out for you. I know you think that it ain't too far. But I hear a call of a lifetime ring. Felt the need to get up for it. Oh, and cut out the middleman. Get free from the middleman. You got no time for the